A whole city is going to sleep. A forest of ice is growing around us. No one can see us anymore. Do they even know what's happening here? Are they being allowed to know? Radio Leningrad tells the truth, or part of it. But that's because it's local. The people who speak on the radio are hungry too, you can tell. It shouldn't make any difference whether they know in Moscow what we're going through in Leningrad, but it does. They may not be able to do anything for us, but to be lost from people's thoughts is like a second death. When this drawing is finished, she'll do another. She'll draw until her paper gives out. It doesn't matter if her hands are clumsy. She'll draw Yevgenia's face with the freckles standing out on it and her big wide mouth smiling. Zina holding out the baby as if she wanted to give it away. The baby's shriveled face. Andrei leaning against the inside of the door. The wound in her father's shoulder that won't heal. She shuts her eyes and tests herself. Yes, they're all there. She can see them in every detail. Anna wraps a blanket around Andrei on top of his coat and tucks it in. He doesn't stir. Those soot marks are still on his face, so she spits on her handkerchief and gently wipes them off. Then she blows out the guttering end of the candle. Chapter 20. What are days? You wake hours before it's light, from hunger. Hunger has burrowed deep into your stomach and is eating away at you. You turn, moaning, trying to dislodge it. You taste the foulness of your breath. The day begins like a day of fever. Strange dreams and voices march over your mind as you slip in and out of sleep. Someone laughs close to your ear. Suddenly you catch the scent of coffee. Blue smoke drifts from a ventilation shaft. Inside they are roasting coffee beans, then grinding them and packing the grains into stiff brown paper bags which are sealed with white labels. They stack the bags plumply on shelves. It is morning, and it isn't winter anymore, but summer, with light streaming through the shop window. The fragrance of coffee wreathes around your head like smoke. You wake yourself, snuffling around in the bedclothes. A load of blankets and coats weighs you down, but you're still cold. Your feet are numb, and your breath comes short. The cold settles in your back and makes your spine hurt. You must breathe gently. You must not be restless. Every movement destroys energy, which you no longer possess. In the next apartment, a baby cries steadily from hunger. The crying goes on and on, threading its way into the innermost coils of your brain. If only he'd stop. Whatever it takes, make him stop. There is no electricity. There is no running water. It is the 12th of December. Leningrad is garlanded with ice, pinned down by heavy blankets of snow. Later, the low, slanting light of winter will glide along the blue banks of the Neva. There will be streaks of rose on the snow. The bread ration is now 250 grams per day for workers and 125 grams for everyone else. How much is that? A couple of slices of bread. One, if you cut thickly. But you don't cut thickly. You cut the bread into tiny cubes. You moisten each one with saliva. As long as it lasts, you have food in your mouth. But your stomach tears at you. It's not fooled. In bread queues, people talk about the ice road over Lake Ladoga. A road made of ice, tracking over miles of unstable ice. The one route that now connects Leningrad to the mainland. Lake Ladoga, northeast of Leningrad, is the only way out. The young ice has already swallowed up dozens of trucks and men, but it's freezing hard, and the ice is getting thicker. Soon they'll be able to bring in supplies. Food will come. It's early days yet, and of course they're losing trucks and men. Ladoga's ice is still treacherous, freezing solid enough to take a tank in one place, and then opening into a crevasse a couple of hundred metres farther on. The Germans know that it's the only supply route left, and they started shelling it almost as soon as the first trucks rolled out onto the ice. But whatever's sacrificed has got to be sacrificed. The ice road is all we've got. It must be believed in. They're already calling it the Road of Life. The bread queue mutters its creed, and blue lips pray for the temperature to drop, the ice to thicken further, the route to become faster, safer. Now we've recaptured Dickvin. The crossing won't take so long. They won't have to go all that way round.
Well, they're working day and night to get the stuff to us. I heard there are thousands of tons of flour backed up at Novaya Ladoga.
They're opening up new tracks over the ice all the time. They've got fuel stations and first aid posts all the way, every kilometre. That'll speed things up.
But what they believe in remains invisible. There's no food here. They have been queuing for 2.5 hours and there's still no sign of bread. There were problems with the ovens this morning, someone says.
Anna huddles deeper into her coat, stamps her feet, and listens to the distant noise of shelling.
She thinks of Lake Ladoga, beautiful in summer with its glistening iron and silver water, its cranberry marshes, birches, wild duck, and reeds. The lake is deep, packed with fish and legends. But André says that Ladoga is nothing to Lake Baikal.
It's no more than a puddle.
He'll take her to Baikal one day,
when they go to Siberia together.
We have fish as big as whales, he says, and the water of Lake Baikal is the purest in the world.
He explains why this is so, but she doesn't bother to take it in. She imagines them both, in summer, on a wooden jetty which thrusts out far into the waters of Lake Baikal. They're not fishing or swimming. They're just sitting there, doing nothing, close together. Her head is on his shoulder, and his hand cups her cheek. The sun is on their backs, and their breathing rises and falls in time to the distant cluck of water on the far-off grey stones of the shore. André tells her that stones from the Baikal shores bring good luck, so she's put a handful in her pocket. She reaches in and touches their round, smooth surfaces. The air smells of spice and pine, and the water breathes out its own virgin sweetness.
You see, I told you you'd love it here, says André. Without looking at him, she knows that his Siberian eyes have squeezed up into slits as he smiles at her.
Yes, she says. You're right. I love it here. Across miles of water there are mountains, marching away into wilderness.
No one goes there, says André, apart from hunters.
I'll take you up to the snow line tomorrow.
But the sun on her back is warm. No, she says. Let's not go anywhere. Let's just stay here.
The woman ahead of Anna in the queue is wearing a heavy fox fur coat and a fox fur hat. But in spite of her clothes, she is trembling so much that the little fur tail on her hat bobs up and down and bounces on her shoulders as if it's alive. Suddenly the woman turns and grasps Anna's arm. Her face is the colour of old candle grease and her hands grip hard, digging into Anna.
Help me. I don't feel well.
Anna staggers. Her body will not take the weight of this woman.
Sit down, she says. Rest for a minute. The queue's not moving.
But suspicion lights in the woman's blurred, starved eyes. It could be a trick to steal her place in the queue. One hand lets go of Anna to scrabble inside her coat and check if the ration card is still there. Maybe Anna has used this moment of weakness to slide a hand in and take it. Without a ration card, you die. There's no getting another, not now Pavlov's tightened everything up. The woman gives a sob of relief as she finds the edge of her card and rubs her finger against it as if she's touching a holy medal. But she still glares suspiciously at Anna.
Rest for a minute. I'll keep your place, says Anna.
The woman's gloves, too, are made of fox fur.
The fur is reddish, soft, glistening.
It looks so much more alive than the woman is wearing it.
You can't buy a fur coat of that quality in any shop Anna's ever been into.
The woman's colourless lips open.
I want to live, she whispers, as if it's the biggest secret of all.
She leans all her weight onto Anna.
Quick, the queue's moving, says Anna.
The woman lets go and lunges forward. The queue stirs, shifts, but does not move, while Anna steps back out of the reach of the woman's praying hands and folds her own arms across her chest. Her head hurts.
She tries to recapture the jetty with its warm, sunlit wood, the feel of André's shoulder, and the muscled leap of a fish far out on the water. But they will not come. Someone behind her is whispering about the ice road now. The rate we're losing trucks, there won't be any left soon. But some of them they're getting through all the same, replies another woman. They know how bad things are here. They're doing the best they can, working night and day. As long as people know about us, we are not alone. Not left in the dark like abandoned children to freeze and starve. They're getting through, Anna repeats under her breath. They will come. We will live and not die. She sees the ghostly whiteness of the frozen lake, swept by mist and snowstorms, and the wavering track the supply trucks have to follow. Perhaps there are flags stuck in the ice to guide the trucks from station to station. The Finns believe an ice woman lives there, far out on the ice, where the water is deepest. She calls through the storms to draw to herself a human lover. Male or female, she doesn't care. What she wants is what she hasn't got. Warm flesh and a beating heart. Each lover can only warm her for a moment before she freezes him. The trucks churn on over the ice. There are weak patches and crevasses. There is wind that stings with driving snow. It hisses, carrying sound. Daroga zhizni. Daroga zhizni. This is the road of life, the only chance you've got. Broken down trucks litter the sides of the track. But although the blizzard is dangerous, it's less dangerous than the German planes, which it keeps on the ground. Sacks of flour, meat essence, butter, tinned fish, cereals, ammunition, baby milk. Anna wills the trucks forward. They must come, whatever happens, over hundreds of miles of emergency track built across the Ladoga marshlands and over the ice onto the railway that will bring them to Leningrad. The German pincers can't quite close on this last supply route. They bomb it whenever the sky clears, but winter is on our side. The ice grows thicker. Engines groan as the trucks labour on. It is 20 degrees below zero out on the ice, and the wind blows hard, stripping heat from men and machines. The sacks of flour are tightly packed, but even so they judder as the trucks judder. These are not sacks of flour, but days of life. If a truck rolls into a crevasse, this number of people will die. If a truck gets through, this number will live. Kolya will grab his bread. Anna will give it to him bit by bit to make sure that he chews it properly, instead of swallowing it like a dog. He must chew in order to extract every morsel of goodness from the bread. She will smear it with a few drops of the sunflower oil she bartered for her mother's sheepskin coat. Collier's whole life is in his mouth. The bread queue surges. It's arrived, the bread which is still called bread, even when it's mostly cellulose and warehouse sweepings. The smell of it drifts out as if from the lips of heaven. In front of Anna, the woman in the fox furs begins to cry and laugh, crossing herself over and over. She had believed there would be no bread today. That today the ration would simply cease to be. It would disappear like the last little circle of water that a wild duck struggles to keep open in winter by constantly swimming round and round in the same spot. Anna shuffles forward, feeling for the ration cards where they lie in the secret pocket she has sewn into the lining of her coat. She won't take the cards out until the moment when she's at the head of the queue. Ration cards are not like gold. They are so far above gold that you can't even make the comparison. Before she even picks up her bread, she'll hide the cards again. If there are thieves about, better lose one day's ration than the cards. You can survive a day without bread, just about, but you can't survive without ration cards until the end of the month. She and Marina have discussed over and over again the risks of Anna collecting the rations for the whole family. What if she fainted and was robbed of the cards? It would be safer if she and Marina went together. But someone must stay with her father and Kolya. And although Anna doesn't say it,
She knows she is now the only one with the strength for the daily walk to the bakery and for hours of queuing. Marina's cough is bad.
Anna prepares for her daily walk to the bakery as carefully as a marathon runner. She eats the quarter slice of bread she has saved from her ration and tucks another quarter slice into her pocket to eat if she begins to feel dizzy. She drinks a glass of hot water with a pinch of salt. She warms her jacket, coat, gloves and scarf at the Bujwika before putting them on. She heats foot cloths, wraps them around her feet, and then puts on her father's felt boots. She does everything slowly, according to a set pattern. Whenever her heart beats too fast, she stops and rests. She always takes her father's cherrywood walking stick to the bread queue. If she slipped on the uncleared ice and snow, she might never be able to get up again. And besides, the solidity of the stick in her hand is good. If someone tried to rob her, she would hit them with it. She's seen people grappling in the snow, fighting in slow motion over a crust of bread. She swathes her face with her shawl until only her eyes show. Each time, before Anna leaves, Marina makes the sign of the cross over her. The gesture means nothing to Anna, and a few weeks earlier it would have irritated her, but now she lets Marina do it. It's another part of the ritual of setting out. "Be careful," they all say.
"Be careful, Anna,"
pipes Kolya, staring at her from the mattress where Marina has laid out the fort and the toy soldiers. Sometimes he strokes his toys, but he hasn't the energy to play with them anymore. The bread is in her hands. A second later she has stuffed it into the cloth bag around her waist. Both bread and ration cards are invisible as she makes her way back through the frozen streets. The light is already fading. The grip of frost hardens and the tip of her walking stick skids on ice. Anna rights herself, breathing hard. Sweat springs out all over her body as the bread ration knocks against her under her coat. She must not allow herself to fall. They're waiting for her, counting the minutes until she comes back. The Bujwika will be cold by now, but they'll be huddling together under the blankets to share their warmth. Marina might be singing to Kolya. She knows a lot of songs, and although her singing is more like a sort of rhythmic talking, it always calms him down. Funny that Marina can't sing. But she can soothe Kolya when he has one of those fits of hopeless, hungry crying that make Anna feel like jumping out of the window. Or maybe Kolya's doing his breathing exercises. When they get to Leningradskaya Pravda, they read every word, stripping it for meaning. Sometimes there are four sheets, sometimes only two. When everyone has read it, they spread the newspaper on the mattress, and Kolya does the breathing exercises that are supposed to help his asthma. "Swim with your arms, Kolya. Make the paper crackle." Kolya's arms move stiffly. Anna turns him over and lays her hand on his diaphragm. "Breathe in, Kolya." "That's right, slowly. And now out, all the way. Watch my hand go up and down." Kolya peers down his chest to watch her hand. When it moves, a fleeting smile crosses his old man's face.
"I'm good at breathing, aren't I, Anna?"
After that, they put away the newspaper to light next day's fire. Kolya will be looking out for her.
"Where's Anna?"
he'll ask. And Marina will say, "Don't worry. She'll be back soon. It's a long way to the bakery."
"But I'm so hungry."
She fights her way onward. A man passes her, pulling a sledge on which the starved contours of a human body poke through the sheet that covers it. One of the runners catches on a lump of ice, and the sledge sticks. The man jerks it free. She sees what lies there with terrible clarity, as if the man has stripped away the sheet. Forehead, nose, jaw, shallow breast, jutting ribs and pelvis. It's a child's body. The sledge runs lightly over the snow, bouncing a little. Anna feels in her pocket and touches the emergency quarter slice of bread that rests there. She hasn't felt dizzy today. Once again, she hasn't had to eat the last quarter slice of bread. Once again, she'll be able to add it to Kolya's ration. Chapter 21. It was too late for the little girl. Her veins collapsed, and before they could get a line in, she died. A camphor injection hadn't done anything. As far as cause of death, you could take your pick. Dysentery, dehydration, shock. But she'd died of hunger. There are only two causes of death left, shelling and starvation. The mother is still crouching by the iron cot, holding her daughter's hand. She is silent. Andrei straightens himself slowly, easing his back, and puts a hand on the woman's shoulder. But he doesn't say anything either. What is there to say? What words of comfort for the loss of a child who need never have died at all? The little girl's name was Nadia. 10 minutes ago he spoke her name into the bluish, shrunken face, although he already knew there was no calling her back.
"Talk to her. She can still hear you," he said to the mother.
For a while she sat there, bundled up, impassive. She looked 60, but was probably 35. Suddenly she seemed to realise what was happening. Her face quivered. She threw herself forward so that her mouth was almost touching the child's, and words began to pour out of her. "Stay with me. Don't leave me. My treasure, my little soul. Look, I've brought you your little woolly cat, the one you love." But the child's face remained rigid. It's over. Andrei sways with tiredness. 9 o'clock, and there'll be a cup of barley soup for him in the canteen. Never mind that it'll be water haunted by barley, rather than the rich, hot, savoury soup his body craves. He has a half slice of bread in his pocket for Kolya. Anna's face will unclench when she sees it. She'll prod the bread with her quick fingers, as if it might not be real. And then she'll frown and interrogate him about what he had to eat at the hospital. "Because you've got to have your ration, Andrei, when you're on your feet all day long, and then you've got to get home afterwards." Home. That's what they both call it now. Home isn't the apartment, or even the room warmed by the buzhuika. It's the mattress where they curl together at night, with Kolya breathing beside them. They don't kiss. She doesn't sigh and press her body against his. They don't ache for each other anymore. They rest, wadded in their winter coats, like climbers bivouacked on an icy mountain. They lie cupped against each other, and still. His training tells him that this is because their starving bodies have shut down in order to survive. Their bodies know more than they do. If she weren't there, would he ever be able to sleep? When he lies like this, close to Anna, breathing her sour breath, he feels as if they are no longer separate at all. They are the same. When she sighs or moves, it's as if this is happening inside his own flesh. When she swallows a crust of bread dipped in tea, he feels the warmth of it flushing his own skin. They are high on the mountain, and ice tears at their flesh. He doesn't know if they will live. Her face is sallow, her lips cracked at the corners. In the mornings, her eyelids are stuck together with yellow crusts. He is the same. Slowly, slowly, they creak into life. They mustn't keep on lying there. He's heard too many stories of whole families sinking together into the stupor of death. She lights the buzhuika and warms a pot of water which has frozen overnight. She dips a cotton rag in the water and wipes his eyes until the crust is gone. He blinks. There she is. They look at one another without speaking. The day is in front of them, stretching out, a wasteland of hunger that they must shape. She nods at him. They are together. She is with him.
"I'll go and change your father's dressings."
"Good. I'll make tea." They can make tea out of anything. Often they make it out of plain water with a touch of sugar or salt. "Kolya," she says then. "Kolya. Time to wake up." She won't let Kolya sleep on too late into the morning. She insists that the days keep their shape. There's not enough warm water to wash properly, but they can at least wipe themselves clean. She combs Collier's hair, massages his hands and feet to get his circulation going, and brushes his teeth very gently, because Collier's gums bleed and his teeth are loose. By then the water is hot, and he can have his tea. "The bakeries will be open already," she tells him. "They opened at 6 o'clock. They'll be baking your bread now, Collier." Then, because they've got a stub of candle, she does a little reading with him. He's so quick, a real little Levin. A few months ago he'd have zipped through the pages. But now he doesn't remember the words. She points to them. "What does that say, Collier? Can you remember? And that one?" That is home, where Anna is.
"Yes," Andrei promises himself. "I'll finish all this, and then I'll go home."
Andrei is swallowing the last of his soup when the surgeon he worked under last spring stops by his table.
"I've been looking for you."
Pavel Nikolaevich is a chunky man with spatulate fingers. He looks more like a tram driver than anyone's idea of a surgeon. But Andrei's seen those fingers at work and knows the skills built into each of them. Pavel Nikolaevich takes a small packet out of his coat.
"Here, something for you."
"Thank you." Andrei reaches out and takes the packet, which is squashy and heavy for its size. He doesn't ask what it is. These days, you say your thanks and don't ask questions. The professor leans close.
"Guinea pig," he whispers. "Incredibly enough, Tamara was still keeping a few of the lab animals alive, giving them hay and so on. So there you are. The South Americans regard guinea pig as a great delicacy, I believe."
"I can't thank you enough."
"Rubbish. If we don't keep you young doctors going, who'll look after us when we're old men? Besides, you know, I have no dependents. These days that's a blessing. Now put that away before anyone sees it. They'll all be wanting some."
He pats Andrei's shoulder and walks on. "What's that, Andryusha?"
"Meat."
"Meat? What meat? Where did you get it?"
"Someone gave it to me."
"But what is it? Dog? Cat?"
"No, better than that. Wait a minute."
He's already unwrapped the packet once in the hospital and seen the little stiff, furred corpse. "Let me see it. Andrei!"
"No, not yet. Why don't I cook it first?"
Her face blanches. She steps back from him.
"What kind of meat is it?" she whispers hoarsely.
Her face is stiff with horror. At once he knows what she suspects.
"No, Anna, no, I swear it's not that. It's nothing bad. It's a guinea pig."
"A guinea pig?" She puts her hand over her mouth.
"You're sure, Andrei? Who gave it to you? You hear such things."
He has heard them too, in the market and in the bread queue, even among the doctors. Andrei believes in what he's seen, not in rumours. People whisper of corpses with missing limbs, and of children who disappear. They say there are cannibals trading in the Sanaya market now, hawking unidentifiable meat pate. Quickly he turns his mind away.
"Of course it's a guinea pig. Look at it. Fur and all."
"Oh, yes."
"But we'll have to skin it."
"You can do that. You're used to dissecting things. I'll work out how to cook it. We haven't lit the bujuika yet, because there's only one bookshelf left." The room is icy. Collier, swathed in blankets, is perched on Marina's knee. She must have been reading him a story, but she's fallen into the sudden sleep that keeps overtaking all of them. Anna's father, under his mound of blankets, is also sleeping. Collier's sharp little face turns to Anna.
"Marina's been asleep for a long time, but I didn't wake her up."
"Good boy." "Guess what, Collier? We're going to have meat. Andrei's brought it. You can help me get the stove ready."
"Meat," says the child, as if he doesn't quite remember what it is.
"Yes, and then I'm going to make soup from the bones, like we do."
"When your daddy and Marina smell soup, they'll soon wake up."
But Marina is already struggling out of sleep.
"Soup? Let me make it.
You and Andre must rest. You both look exhausted.
As she crosses to the kitchen, she checks Mikhail, as she always does, and pulls the blankets closer around him. Anna won't believe it, she says, but her father was awake for quite a long time earlier. While you were in the bread queue, Anna. He even talked, didn't he, Kolya?
Your father was talking to us, wasn't he?
Yes, says Kolya, but uncertainly.
Anna massages Andrei's legs while the meat cooks. They've decided to make a stew so as not to lose any of the meat's goodness. They can eat strips of meat today, then the soup tomorrow. The rare, savoury smell of cooking meat fills the apartment.
The next moment, there's a knock on the door.
Someone smells meat, says Marina.
I'll go. And whoever it is, I'll stop them at the door. They mustn't come in. If word gets out that we've got meat... What if it's Zina? I can't give her any more. I promised Marina.
It is Zina, with the baby in her arms. She stands in the doorway and holds him out to Anna, as she did before.
I think he's ill. Do you think it's a cold, or maybe an ear infection?
The baby has been dead for at least 3 days, Anna judges, as she takes him into her own arms. The icy cold of Zina's room has preserved him, but he is dry and blue, and his half-open eyes show slits of white.
Zina, he's cold. I wondered if we could come in. You said it was warm by your stove.
Zina, where's your Fedya? Has he seen the baby?
He hasn't been home since last week. You know, he's on the defence committee at work. My Fedya never stops. He's practically a Stakhanovite.
Zina, you know, don't you, that the baby...
Zina reaches up and puts her hand over Anna's mouth.
Don't say anything, Anna. Brings bad luck.
She takes back her baby and rocks him gently.
He's so beautiful, isn't he? And we haven't even got a photograph of him. My mother's never seen him, you know. So I came to ask you, Anna Mikhailovna, you know that drawing you did, the one you showed me of your little Kolya when he was a baby? I wondered if you would draw my baby so I can send the picture to my mother.
The smell of meat floats into the tiny hallway.
Wait here a moment, Zina.
Anna goes back into the apartment, snatches out paper and pencil, whispers in Marina's ear, and returns to Zina, who still stands in exactly the same position, her face peacefully bent over the baby.
We'll do the drawing in your apartment. It's quieter there.
In their coats, boots and hats, the two women sit opposite one another. Zina cradles her baby. From time to time she bends and whispers to him. For the first time in her life, Anna doesn't attempt to draw what she sees. She draws the baby as she remembers him in his early weeks, before the siege began. A breastfed baby, already rounding out nicely, with a few feathers of damp, dark hair. One plump hand clutches the edge of his shawl. His eyes are open, and they find his mother's gaze. She draws quickly, because Zina is beginning to tremble.
There you are. I can do a copy later on, if you like, so you've got one to keep and one to send to your mother.
Zina stares at the drawing.
Oh, it's just like him. That's exactly the way he looks at me. And his hands look. That's just the way they hold the shawl.
Anna does not look at the baby's purple claw curled over the edge of the blanket in which Zina has wrapped him.
My mum's going to be so thrilled when she sees this.
Zina shifts the baby into her right arm, takes the drawing and puts it carefully away under the bed.
My Fedya will frame it. He can do anything like that.
Then she returns and faces Anna.
I know he isn't...
She swallows.
Looking his best just now.
No... Because he's...
I know. Don't think I don't know. It's just I don't want to talk about it. And when my Fedya comes home, he'll do everything that should be done.
Of course he will. Anna, Andrei and Kolya eat the tender, savoury meat, while Marina spoons broth into Mikhail's mouth.
This is funny meat, says Kolya. I've never tasted it before.
It's a special kind of meat they've brought in over the ice road.
Can we have it again?
Tomorrow, you'll have meat soup with your bread.
I don't want my last bit, Kolya. You have it.
Later, after the others have gone to sleep, there are just the two of them again. They lie face to face, whispering, feeling each other's dry lips move. His breath smells of meat, and she knows her own must, too.
"We stink," she says.
Now the pipes are frozen. There's no running water in the apartment. For some reason, a tap in the courtyard is still working, although water is so heavy that they carry only the bare minimum upstairs. But they're lucky, not like Tanya. Every day she sees more people on their way down to the Neva, stumbling with their buckets, clambering down to the ice. God knows what's in that water now.
Anna dreams of a steam bath, her naked flesh red with heat, her sweat trickling down breasts and thighs and prickling at the roots of her hair. Women wade through clouds of steam, their heads small above mountains of breast, belly, buttock and thigh. They sit on wooden benches and snort with content. Every particle of dirt is steamed out of their pores.
Anna's skin itches. It's days now since she's taken off her clothes. She disgusts herself.
I'm so dirty, she says. I love you more and more. Don't go to sleep yet. I'm afraid.
What are you afraid of?
My father's going to die soon. Marina says he wakes up, but I don't think he does. Only in her mind. I feel as if we're somewhere else, not here on Earth at all.
Andrei shifts his swollen legs.
That's because it's night. Tomorrow I'll see if I can get a spoonful of cod liver oil for Kolya. Masha at the dispensary said they might have some. A few drops a day will make all the difference. And you'll go for the bread ration, and we'll come home and eat. We'll get through another day. We'll still be on Earth. As long as you're alive, I'll stay alive.
You promise?
Yes, I promise.
But my father will die.
Yes. Yes, I think he will.
Frost and snow gather, thickening centimetre by centimetre on windows, roofs, parks, railways, and the bodies of the dead. Slowly the city sinks down, like a great ship sinking in an ice field. Its lights have gone out. Its water no longer flows. Production in factories has all but stopped. The ship is poised, ready to dive into the blackness of death. Only its people keep on stubbornly living, as if they don't know that it's all over for them. The next morning, Anna finds a small onion, which must have rolled off the store cupboard shelf and hidden itself among the bristles of her broom. She grabs Andrei's arm with a cry of joy. Sobbing, she says to him, "You were right. You knew all the time. We're going to be all right, I know it. This is a sign, that's what it is. A sign!" He looks at her dry, swollen lips, her sharp cheekbones and sunken eyes. He looks at the little onion which she is holding out in triumph. "Yes," he agrees. "It's a sign." She slices the onion finely and adds it to the meat broth which she has saved for Kolya with a pinch of salt and a cup of water. The vitamins will do him so much good. She lights the stove with kindling from the last bookshelf. Soon the soup is simmering. Marina, Andrei and Anna gather round to watch Kolya swallow his meat soup with onion. Anna spoons it into his mouth.
"There you are. It's good, isn't it? Now you'll grow up to be a big boy."
After eating, the child goes back into a fuddled drowse. Sometimes he whimpers. Anna notes that Marina has not even suggested keeping back any of the broth for her father.
"I was listening to the radio," says Marina. "There was a nutritional expert on last night. She said there's nourishment in wallpaper paste."
"But we haven't got any."
"We have. Kolya's fought. We used wallpaper paste to make the papier-mâché.
If I strip off the painted layer, we could cook the rest of it. There's bound to be some calories in it.
But what will Kolya say? He got so upset when I said we might have to use it for fuel for the Buzhuika.
Yes, but if it's for food, that's different.
While Kolya sleeps, Marina works for hours, peeling off the thinnest possible layer of painted papier-mâché from the fort and putting the rest to soak in water.
The paper will float to the top and the goodness of the paste will remain in the water. We can make it into a kind of soup for him.
Don't tell him.
No. We'll say we've put the fort away for safety until the blockade is lifted.
Yes, let's say that. Chapter 22. Again, it's the dead of night, but this time she's alone. The others are in the room, of course, Kolya on the mattress next to her, pressed against her. Marina on the other side of Kolya, sleeping. They lie like this, the adults sandwiching the child, so that their body heat will keep him warm. But Andrei is not here, and without Andrei she feels cold and fearful. She's restless, thinking of him at work. He's sleeping at the hospital tonight. She made him promise. Outside it's -20, and she's afraid that on a night like this he could collapse on the way home and freeze to death.
There is typhus in one of the nearby children's homes, he says, where orphans are crammed together. What if Andrei gets typhus? In his starved state he'd have no resistance. What if he simply didn't come home from the hospital one night? Would anyone there think to inform her if he was taken ill? Of course not. They don't even know that she exists, let alone that Andrei is living here.
A voice stirs beside her. It's Marina.
Let's talk. It'll pass the time.
What?
You're awake, aren't you?
Yes, I'm awake. What time is it?
11:30.
Only 11:30.
You've been asleep.
Have I?
Yes. You were asleep when I got up.
Marina, you've lit the Buzhuika.
I had to make tea for your father.
What did you use?
The encyclopedia.
Oh.
I thought it was the one he'd missed least.
I suppose so.
And there are 12 volumes.
They speak quietly, although they lie on the same mattress, because Kolya is between them. But he is deeply asleep, with the flaps of his fur cap muffling his ears.
And then the cold space on Anna's other side, where Andrei should be.
So many hours before it gets light, says Anna.
Your father's been awake, too. He only went back to sleep about 30 minutes ago. We've been talking for a long time.
It's strange how he only talks when no one but you can hear him, says Anna. Her heart beats fast as she waits for Marina's answer.
You think he doesn't talk to me? You think I'm lying?
No, not that.
You think I invent it?
Maybe.
Why should I do that?
Because you want him to talk to you.
There are a lot of things you don't know, Anna.
Her voice is sharp in the darkness. I know, says Anna. People have been telling me that all my life. I never had time to finish my education.
Shall we talk properly, then? Asks Marina, her voice changing. Shall we stop all this? I could tell you a story.
It's still only 11:30. 6.5 hours before the bakery is open. The night hangs like lead. All right, says Anna.
You know the people in my story. You'll have your own version, but let me tell you mine, and then you can tell me yours.
Anna draws up her knees and pulls Kolya more deeply into the bony cradle of her body, under the layers of blankets. She tucks his hands into her armpits, where they'll be warm. He sleeps on.
You realize that your father and I have known each other for a long time.
Of course.
I was 32 when I first met him. He was a couple of years older, with a wife and a 4-year-old daughter.
Your father was very interested in Tairov's work. You'll have heard of Tairov. He was in Moscow, directing at the Kamerny Theatre, which he'd founded just before the war. Misha had been reading Tairov's book, Notes of a Director.
It wasn't long after he'd staged Phèdre. I remember that the first time we met, we argued about that production. We'd both been to Moscow to see it. Your father was still hoping to write for the stage then.
But he never did.
No. So, we argued. He told me straight away that he was married. And about you. He used to tell me how clever you were, because you could already read when you were only four. But from what I could see, he wasn't at home very much. Those were such different times. And although it's only 20 years ago, it's passed away so completely you can't guess what it was like unless you remember it.
There's nothing so very different, says Anna, about men who get married and have babies and then find that they don't want to be at home very much.
It was a new world, says Marina. That's what we believed. Everything had changed so fast, and it was still changing. And the theatre was right in the heart of it. It was 1922. For the first time ever, we had a mass audience. We had soldiers and factory workers coming in with free tickets they'd been given. Theatre was going to be for everyone. They came to everything. They listened to everything. They talked about everything. They ate and drank as if they were in their own homes. And they didn't dress up. They just poured in their boots and overcoats. They wanted theatre because they'd never had it before. Everybody wanted it. Everybody wanted us. Ensembles sprang up. Actors flung ideas at the audience. There were experiments going on everywhere. Some of them worked, and some of them didn't. The whole of theatre turned into a giant stage where you were always in danger of being pushed back into the wings if artistic politics left you behind. The spotlight might suddenly shine on you, or it would go off and you'd be alone. And yet there was so much freedom. We didn't live in a fog, stumbling with one arm in front of our faces to ward off what was coming next. We knew the future was rushing towards us, and we raced to embrace it. I sleep a lot now. But in those years, I hardly went to bed. I'd go to sleep at 2 in the morning, and at 7 I'd snap out of bed wide awake and run to rehearsals. And everyone else would be up too. Imagine actors getting up before 10. And yet they didn't look worn out and grey. Everyone looked beautiful, even those who were ugly. You've no idea, Anna, because you've grown up with what came after. The time of hope didn't last long. Everything solidified so quickly after only a few years. They closed down one of Bulgakov's plays and banned the Crimson Island. There wasn't allowed a single performance. By that time, people were measuring what they said and thinking about where to align themselves. There was such fear. It's one thing for a poet to speak out. He can always write poems. But an actor or a director has got to have a theatre. He's got to be part of something, or else he's nothing. People saw that they'd be out in the wilderness if they made the wrong choices.
People, thinks Anna. Always people. I want to know about you, not about people. I thought you were going to talk about what happened between you and my father.
Yes, but this isn't background. It's all part of it.
Those rounded, authoritative syllables. You have to believe her. But don't forget that Marina has been trained to make people believe what she says. Corlia sighs and shudders. A bad dream, nothing more. Anna pushes her hand under his coat and rubs his back, over the knobs of his spine, across his ribs, up to the wings of his shoulder blades. There. Sleep now. Sleep.
In the second year I became pregnant, says Marina. By that time I knew your mother. We'd been introduced. We liked one another. I used to come to the house. We were becoming real friends. Kitchen friends.
And what?
I had an abortion, as everybody did. It was perfectly normal. I didn't tell your father until afterwards.
There is silence for a while. What did he say?
He was angry.
So he wanted another house and another baby not to go home to. Was that it?
No. He said it was our baby, part of our life. He said I should have told him before I had the abortion.
But he wouldn't have done anything.
Of course not. He loved your mother. I knew that by then. but he was still angry with me.
It's true. He can stay angry for a long time.
He asked me if the fetus was male or female.
What did you say?
I said I didn't know.
Did you?
It was male. I was 4 months pregnant.
You left it late?
Through stupidity. Thinking I might tell him, and then pulling back from it, and then thinking again that I might tell him.
But you didn't?
No.
It's finished. It's a long time ago.
But that was the end of things between us. After that, we were friends.
That wasn't what you wanted.
No. But I could tell that it was an effort for him to touch me, so I preferred not to be touched.
When my mother died, did you ever think...
No, I never thought of it. I knew it would not happen.
She says it coldly and clearly, as if she's giving a statement to the authorities.
So there you are, says Marina. That's my story.
They lie silent in the dark.
Her father breathes snoringly.
Corlia twitches, then goes still. The room smells of the books Marina has burned. How many volumes did you burn, Marina?
2. It's good paper, and the boards are almost as thick as wood.
We'll burn 2 more in the morning. Anna thinks of the bright, hot flame that will spurt from those books. She'll hold her hand so close that her bones show through the flesh. The flames will lap at her palms. Who could have ever imagined such ecstasy while the radiators still worked? Her whole life will be in her hands, and Corlia will sit between her knees, his face lit, his candle-pale skin flushed a rose.
Of course that wasn't the truth, says Marina.
What?
Do you want the real story?
Yes.
We recognized each other right from the first moment. We hadn't any choice. That's what I thought. He's dying now, and perhaps I'll die too. Nobody will ever know what happened. There was no child, and now there's not even any story left. Everything will be rubbed out. That's what they do to enemies of the people, isn't it, Anna? They're erased from the records. So I'll tell you, even if you don't want to hear,
even if you think I'm your enemy.
I was already well known. I was used to things being as I wanted them to be. The roles I wanted, the tables I wanted in restaurants, summers in the Crimea. I was used to respect. Nothing had ever caught me and held me and made me do things I didn't want to do and go to places I didn't want to go.
But your father did all that.
He captured me like a fish. And then he tried to throw me back into the water. But it was too late. I'd spent too much time up in the air, and I was damaged. I wasn't as beautiful anymore, either to him or to myself. I couldn't repair myself. I couldn't even swim away. I sank to the bottom of the water, and I hid there, in the mud. I believed that the mud was where I belonged. I wanted the child, but I knew that your father wouldn't be prepared to become its father. He would stay with Vera, and with you. My child would depend on me for everything. Once or twice I imagined telling him, in the heart of the night, after hours of sex, when you seemed to be out of your body. I know, he's your father. I shouldn't be telling you this. I would imagine us talking, soul to soul. Of course it never happened. I didn't have the courage. The doctor I went to was not a pleasant individual. He knew who I was. He kept telling me about how much he loved the theatre and which roles I should take in the future. Plenty of excellent, fatherly advice. But his eyes weren't fatherly. We were in his consulting rooms. He owned me for a while. He was full of understanding for what he called my predicament. What he wanted was for us to conspire together and maybe for me to weep tears on his shoulder. But I wouldn't. I had to open my legs for him, but I would not open my mouth. He actually said to me that he would be interested to come to my next performance, to find out if my experience had affected my art. Your father, of course, knew nothing about any of this. When I told him that I'd had the abortion, later on he wrote a series of poems. They were very good poems. Vera read them. There was never any quarrel. Nothing was said. She simply withdrew. You could be in the same room and it would seem as if she wasn't there. You know how she always read all the drafts of your father's work? At that time she used to write her thoughts on small sheets of yellow paper. Often very good, clear, technical comments. And then she'd clip the yellow sheets to his manuscript. She never wrote on the manuscripts themselves. Your father showed me what she'd attached to the manuscript of the poems he wrote after we'd separated. It was just a short note. In my opinion, these poems, excellent as they are, strike a false note. That was all she ever said. I spent a long time down in the mud thinking about it all. I thought a lot about your mother, too. I wanted her friendship even more now that I'd done this to her, but I couldn't get it. She didn't try to stop me seeing him, nothing like that. She didn't need to. I had to understand that I'd been mistaken from the beginning. We hadn't recognised each other. I'd recognised him, but he'd thought I was someone else. And I saw what a relief it was to him when he believed I wasn't in love with him anymore. He really loved me then. He was so grateful to me for having got over him that he built me up into something remarkable. I remember the tone of the doctor's voice exactly. It was a boy, he said. He wanted me to know that. Not so fatherly at all. And all those letters your father sent to me, the most wonderful letters, years and years of them. I've kept them all. Is Collier still asleep?
Fast asleep.
That's it. Now it's time for you to tell me your story.
There isn't one to tell.
Of course there is.
No, says Anna. Because it's still happening. It hasn't turned into a story yet.
Marina laughs. How like your mother you are.
I hope I am. She's solid, like Vera. She doesn't know what she wants yet, but when she does know...